Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
After receiving hundreds of podcast submissions and nearly 100,000 votes, it's time to crown the winner of the Queen City PodQuest. Which community-submitted podcast will win a cash prize and a podcast development deal with WFAE? Find out at the PodQuest live finale, Saturday, May 4th at the NASCAR Hall of Fame, where you can also cast your vote for fan favorite podcast. Tickets and information at WFAE.org/Queen City PodQuest.
Following the Emancipation Proclamation and the end of the Civil War, the promise of freedom for African Americans was tarnished by ongoing repression, and too many times that repression was enforced by lynching. The South has a history of these sordid events lasting through the middle of the 20th century. Mecklenburg County counts two lynchings among those documented from around the country. Community historian Michael Moore calls these things a form of racial terror to establish and maintain a racial hierarchy and the subordination of black people. He, along with other historians, have been working to uncover this largely ignored or forgotten part of our past, but some of that history is now being told in a new exhibit at the Levine Museum of the New South. The Legacy of Lynching, Confronting Racial Terror in America, runs now through July 17th at the museum, and we are joined for the rest of the hour by the aforementioned Michael Moore. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having us.
And Dr. Willie Griffin is here. He is staff historian at the Levine Museum of the New South. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Good to see you. I know that Dr. Griffin is a civil rights scholar and historian and came to the Levine Museum from the Citadel in Charleston. Michael, you are an independent public or community historian, and you've been working in this city for about 5 years. I'll bet you there are a lot of people who don't know what a community historian is or how you get to be one.
Well, and probably they don't know how great it is to be one in Charlotte.
Really? Yeah.
Yes.
We have history?
You have history. And it may sound strange me saying it, but the pace of change in Charlotte, mm-hmm, and the dynamism of Charlotte has actually, to me, increased interest in Charlotte's history.
Uh-huh.
And so coming here a few years ago, I think this has been a wonderful place for me, okay, as a public historian and urban historian to rethink what I thought I knew about cities.
When we talk about lynching, Dr. Griffin, because lynching has probably taken place since the beginnings of slavery with masters who were just mean jerks. when we talk about lynchings, are we fundamentally talking about what happened after the Civil War, after emancipation?
In this case, yes, we're talking about the emergence of racial terror lynching. I mean, there were lynchings that happened in the Midwest and West as the country was expanding. But for this particular project, the Equal Justice Initiative, we're talking about those racial terror lynchings that emerged at the collapse of Reconstruction.
And lynching suddenly has taken center stage. I mean, it's largely untaught, mostly forgotten, but it's enormously important, according to the two of you, obviously. And we gloss it over. Why?
I think this country, I mean, we like to tell stories that that are not so hard to and heavy. We like to think of this country as being on a progressive track, yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, so
are we? You're the historian. Are we now, or have we ever been?
I think we are on a progressive track. I mean, it's just how we discuss history. I think one of the things that encouraged Bryan Stevenson to start this national dialogue was visiting other countries like Germany, Rwanda, and South Africa, where he's seen these national dialogues actually change the way that we interact with people.
It's easy for us to look back. We're going to talk about these national conversations we're having, but it's easy to look back mm-hmm. and call lynching a form of racial terror. It's exactly what it is, because it was power and control.
Right.
But how did the people doing the lynching see it? Were they aware of what they were doing and the impact it had and the real undercurrent of reasons for why they were doing what they were doing.
The Legacy Museum.
Mm-hmm. That's in Montgomery.
In Montgomery. Alabama. The legacy they're speaking of is the legacy of slavery. Mm-hmm. And underpinning that legacy is a legacy of white supremacy. And once North Carolina and Charlotte was able to reassert that white supremacy that was represented during slavery at the turn of the 20th century.
I mean, it seems on the face of it that they had to have known what they're doing. But I have to ask the question because you can see photographs of hundreds of people in a town square watching this, women, children, young men, old men, and it seems to be family entertainment. We have to take a break and come back, and I want to get your reaction to that in a moment. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about an exhibit at the Levine Museum of the New South, The Legacy of Lynching Confronting Racial Terror in America, which runs through July 17th. Dr. Willie Griffin is here, staff historian there, and Michael Morey, community historian in Charlotte. I just mentioned the fact that a lot of times these, not always, but a lot of times these lynchings took place in the public square. Thousands of people attended. All the town folks turned out, including children, to watch these events. And it was kind of like going to the races or a football game. It was a party.
Yeah.
How do you explain that?
It was a seller.
And postcards floated around the country of these pictures.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, I think the fact that they were held in very public spaces, they were celebrations. They were meant to bring people into an arena to show them that black people were less than. African Americans were less than. They would sometimes leave these bodies hanging for days. People would take souvenirs, take chunks of skin out of people, take out their eyeballs, genitals. So these things were meant to really celebrate and really terrorize the African American community. As you mentioned, postcards were sent all across the country. We just recently had an author in Dr. Seth Koch from the American Studies at UNC, and he talked about if an African American happened to have left the South on the Great Migration, it's very possible that they could be in Massachusetts somewhere and see a postcard to remind them of the lynchings, the kinds of things that they were seeking to escape.
And let's be clear, for people who haven't thought much about this in the past, these are not officially sanctioned hangings.
Right.
These are people taking the law into their own hands while the law turned a blind eye to it. You say that an understanding of lynching and what led to it is enormously important because there are ongoing ramifications of it today. What are they?
Well, part of the reason that Bryan Stevenson started the Equal Justice Initiative was he wanted to explore the roots of mass incarceration and excessive punishment through an examination of this evolution of racial terror lynching. I think that if you look at the statistics that show who actually populates the American jails, the courts, there's a direct link to African Americans being overly targeted for lynching.
Just the same mindset at work?
I think the same mindset. It's evolved. It's evolved a little bit. But I think if you look at popular culture and the way that we look at African Americans who commit crimes versus other races, there's this tendency to say that we have to penalize them a little more because they don't understand. They won't learn.
It's the same. It's the same legacy. It's the same legacy of slavery, and this notion of white supremacy and of black dangerousness, black criminality and black dangerousness, especially among African American men.
Which goes back to slavery and Jim Crow South.
Right. And when we in the exhibition, when we tell the story of the two local victims, Joe McNeely and Willie McDaniel, we also provide a context for how this story that EGI describes on the national level.
What is EGI?
I'm sorry. The Equal Justice Initiative in Birmingham, Alabama, how they describe this continuity of the notion of white supremacy and how it's played out and how it relates to mass incarceration today. We provide that context in Charlotte.
Yeah.
We show that Charlotte and Mecklenburg County, 2 out of 5 residents of Mecklenburg County on the eve of the Civil War, were enslaved.
Right.
We show how, despite fighting for the rights that the federal government provided them, most of those rights were lost in the white supremacy campaign of 1900.
Yeah.
And the white supremacy campaign, the white supremacy clubs in Charlotte were created in a meeting in the mayor's office in City Hall. And then the parade that led the Election Day party of several thousand people through the streets of Charlotte was led on horseback by the chief of police. And so you have a system that is treating black people as less deserving than white people. And
I think you also have to talk about the emergence of the convict leasing system that we don't normally talk about.
It's chain gangs.
The chain gangs.
Where they built the roads.
They built the roads.
Mecklenburg County, evidently, mm-hmm. was notorious for its chain gangs. How
right.
so?
Well, it was the first county in the state to have a permanent chain gang in 1885. It's actually what led to the torture of two African Americans, young African Americans by the name of, I think their names were Woodrow Wilson Shropshire and Robert Barnes in the winter of 1935. They were tortured in one of these chain gang camps, and it actually led to the shutting down of chain gang camps all across the state.
Now let's talk about how you get on a chain gang.
Right.
Yeah,
because as you say, these people were leased out to build roads and do
right.
other things where the state profits and you don't, and certainly the workers didn't. What did you have to do to be sentenced to a chain gang?
In North Carolina, in Mecklenburg County, if you were convicted of any crime, chances are you were going to end up on the chain gang.
Give me an example.
Woodrow Wilson Shropshire uh-huh. in the winter of 1935 was committed of disorderly conduct.
Disorderly conduct.
He got in a fight, public fight. So he goes to the chain gang. He gets disciplined for warming himself by a fire against, you know, without permission of the guard,
right.
and he gets sent into solitary confinement and chained standing up in a cold room for 9 days.
And if you tried to escape these, you may have been there for a minor infraction or what was perceived to be an infraction.
Right.
Sometimes it was trumped up. Mm-hmm. But if you tried to escape, lethal force was used.
That's correct, yeah.
It's interesting that actually Joe McNeely, the 1913 lynching victim
yeah.
in Charlotte, who was taken from his hospital room at Good Samaritan Hospital, located where
Bank of America Stadium is.
Panther Stadium is today, and shot by a mob of as many as 75 people. His older brother, Jim McNeely, was sentenced to the prison camps and was working on the chain gang for stealing chickens. But he was shot and killed escaping the prison camp, his older brother. So he was in there for a misdemeanor. He was committing another misdemeanor, and he was shot and killed without consequence.
And although we may, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I think it's also important to make this link. You asked how could, what kind of crime could get someone, sentenced to a chain gang. You have to make this link from the end of slavery, the vagrancy laws that emerged with the black codes. If you did not have a job, it wasn't uncommon for a local sheriff to scoop you up and really rent you out to a local farm. And so these became sort of the forerunners of chain gangs. Mm-hmm. So these laws that often got African Americans into these chain gangs came out of the black codes.
It was slavery part
yeah.
two,
yeah.
essentially.
And
Davis
and
Douglas
the,
calls
it the
slavery by another name.
Okay.
There's 2 points I'd like to make about I think when we were working on the exhibition, it was a revelation to discover how central the prison camps and the chain gangs were to the criminal justice system statewide and in Mecklenburg County.
Well, UNC Chapel Hill Professor Seth Koch wrote a book called Lethal State, A History of Our Death Penalty in North Carolina. He sees the connection between the death penalty policy mm-hmm. and a relationship to lynching, and I guess to these chain gangs. It's the same thing, different way. essentially. The way we view people, the way we punish people, the way we single out certain individuals for certain kinds of punishments. Is that what you get out of seeing this exhibit and the one in Montgomery, Alabama?
I think you begin to understand that, yes.
90% of the convicts on the chain gangs in Mecklenburg County were African American.
So when were the chain gangs at their height? What years?
They were the main source, the main part of the penal system from the beginning of the 20th century into the 1950s.
Right.
Wow. So,
In North Carolina from 1880 to late 1930s, by World War II, because of this international conflict, many southern states, and particularly the president became very aware that this would look bad on an international stage. So you begin to see slowly states throughout the South begin to discontinue these chain gangs.
Because although the height of lynching evidently occurred in the 1880s and 1890s, the two Mecklenburg County lynchings that you've referenced occurred in the 20th century. Joe McNeely, I think, was in 1913. He was shot. He wasn't hung. He was shot by a crowd who dragged him out of the hospital. And then Willie McDaniel, who was found hanging from a tree in 1929.
Well, he wasn't actually found hanging from a tree. There was evidence that he had been hung from a tree. He had been drugged to an adjoining property to try to conceal the actual crime.
Well, that was 1929. How many more attempts or successful attempts at lynching were there, either in Mecklenburg County or North Carolina, later on in the 20s? When did they stop that we know of?
The last one in North Carolina was in 1946.
And there were often efforts to try to lynch African Americans. There were numerous efforts before the turn of the 20th century in the 1890s where crowds tried to storm prisons or jails, local jails, and tried to bust a supposed criminal out to lynch him.
And most of the targets were African American men, but there were women.
There were women.
There were children. And in Atlanta, there is this famous story of a Jewish I think he was a merchant who was drugged out of a jail and lynched because allegedly he was I've forgotten the exact crime, but there's a whole show up. There's a whole movie.
You can even talk about right locally here in Gastonia, Ella Mae Wiggins. She was in the same year, 1929, the same year as Willie McDaniel. She was an organizer, a labor organizer, trying to bring blacks and whites together under labor unions. And she was targeted and really killed by a mob extrajudiciously.
Is this something that's peculiar and particular to the South, or did this happen all over the country?
I think if you come to the exhibit, you'll see we have a touch screen that will show you exactly where these lynchings occurred, and they happened all across the country. So they weren't just, the majority of them were in the South, but they happened in the North, they happened in the Midwest, they happened in the West, they happened all over the country.
The South, historically, has been a Christian part of the nation. I don't know how to ask this question, but explain the public going along with this and celebrating these travesties of justice and then going to church on Sunday.
That's
hard to explain. And it's not uncommon that leaders, political leaders in Charlotte and across the state who were the leaders of creating the Jim Crow system were also leaders in their church, both locally and across the state.
Do you think that these incidences of racial terror, these lynchings, the chain gangs, are easier for most contemporary people to understand than perhaps why some people want to see Confederate monuments taken away? Do they see the injustice more clearly when it involves human beings who were murdered essentially by mobs?
I think so.
In 1929, Willie McDaniel was lynched. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. 1929 was also the summer that the United Confederate Veterans held their reunion in Charlotte, the same summer.
Do you see a connection there?
Yes, I do. I do, most definitely. The reason I brought that up is because a memorial was built on public land as part of that event
right.
in the summer of 1929, and it still stands there. And what it says, among other things, is that they preserved the Anglo-Saxon civilization of the South and became the master builders in a reunited country.
Yeah.
And I would also add that many of the earlier, sheriffs and organizers of these highway chain gang systems and prison camps were also former Confederate officers. So there's a clear connection there.
Wow. Last year, the Equal Justice Initiative's Legacy Museum and the National Museum for Peace and Justice opened, and we've alluded to this, in Montgomery, Alabama. It has this remarkable way of demonstrating how many people were lynched over the years in America by this display of, for lack of a better term, hanging obelisks that are hanging from the ceiling with names on them for each of the individuals. And the Levine Museum organized a trip down there for that exhibit. Is this exhibit, the one at the Levine right now, an outgrowth of that?
Yes, it is. It's the EGI, in conjunction with the Brooklyn Museum, actually began to design this exhibit. It became a traveling exhibit. After the Brooklyn Museum, it went to Haverford College in Pennsylvania. And so Levine is the third museum, the first in the South, to host this traveling exhibit.
Okay. How does it tell the story?
So we use a number of videos that are testimony that you will probably see. You will see in the same the Legacy Museum in Montgomery that surviving family members testify to how those lynchings have affected their families, how they've been talked about over the years. And so, in addition to those and testimony from Brian Stevenson, who talks about the purpose behind EJI, we provide contacts for the local development of lynchings here, along with the development of the convict leasing system.
What do you hope people take away from coming to this exhibit? Because this is a painful thing to see. I know that you've watched young African Americans looking at this, and they're shocked, and they don't know anything about it, and they've heard about it, but they didn't know exactly what it meant. Now they do. And you've seen white people who've stood there and find it difficult to put them in the place of spectator or participant. So what do you hope people will take away? I only have 10 seconds, 15 seconds.
I hope they take away an understanding of how this system played out in Charlotte, and the legacy that it has left us with now.
Michael Moore is a community historian in Charlotte. Dr. Willie Griffin is the staff historian at the Levine Museum of the New South, where the legacy of lynching confronting racial terror in America will play through the 17th of July. There'll also be a talk in May, which you can find out more about at our website. Thank you both for the hour. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.